You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Fancy Bear left tracks in Bitly, and Fancy Bear did an awful lot of phishing going back to March 2015. Experts take a look at Russian espionage and influence operations, and they draw some disturbing conclusions. The EU seems ready to go anti-encryption. How that will work with the EU's regulatory emphasis on privacy is anyone's guess. And no, that's not a famous theologian tweeting. It's the head G-man. I'm Dave Bittner in Tucson, Arizona, with your CyberWire summary for Friday, March 31st, 2016. As the week ends, interest in Russian cyber operations remains as high as ever. U.S. congressional hearings into the extent of those operations continue, and with heightened attention being drawn by stories of how extensive and aggressive Russian activities were. SecureWorks has been tracking Fancy Bear's activity during the run-up to last year's U.S. elections, and they found that activity to have begun as early as March 2015 and to have prospected over 6,700 people. While there was clearly a lot of interest in the U.S. election, that was far from Fancy Bear's only interest. Targets are said, by Motherboard, to have included members of the U.S. military, diplomats all over the world, Russian government critics, Hillary Clinton campaign staffers, and even Hillary Clinton. It was a phishing campaign, thus typical of the commodity-level approach that continues to pay off well for espionage services. Only 2% of the marks took the fish bait, but when you've trolled through nearly 7,000 accounts, 2% is enough. SecureWorks was able to get the details they did because Fancy Bear left its Bitly URL shortener accounts public, so even bears do leave tracks. At CINET ITSEF 2017 in Mountain View, California, earlier this week, we heard an account of Russian cyber operations that emphasized four of its salient features. First, it has clear objectives in what the Russians view as an ongoing war between themselves and the West, and especially against the U.S. The principal objective is to induce chaos in what Moscow regards as a zero-sum contest. A Western loss, whether financial, social, political, or reputational, counts as Russian gain. As Andrei Krail, CEO of security company Lifars, put it, during the Cold War, quote, if you did harm to the U.S., you were a hero, end quote, and that attitude and policy have persisted beyond the end of the Soviet era. Second, while all espionage services show a tremendous appetite for data, newfound ability to aggregate and correlate data makes any particular loss of a small bit of information far more consequential than it would have been earlier. And as the Hoover Institution's Herb Lin pointed out at ITSEF, the Russian services have by no means been laggard in exploiting information in these new ways. Third, there is no clear line of demarcation between organized crime and Russian espionage services. The services regularly and deliberately make use of organized cybercriminal groups to damage their targets. Lin alluded to unconfirmed reports he learned of to the effect that there have actually been formal memoranda of understanding issued by Russia's Federal Security Bureau to cyber gangs. Fourth, espionage and influence operations are commonly carried out using relatively simple tools. Phishing continues to be used because phishing works. Some of these observations were echoed yesterday at the Billington International Cybersecurity Summit in Washington, D.C. Thomas Donahue, research director at the Cyber Threat Intelligence Center, more familiarly known by its acronym CTIC, noted that intelligence agencies have always had a large and insatiable appetite for information, and so Russian concentration on big data tools is unsurprising, as is their ability to profit from the data they're able to aggregate and correlate. He also said that sophisticated threats, like advanced nation-state espionage services, differ from less sophisticated threats, say small-time criminals or one-off hacktivists, less in terms of the sophistication of their technique than in their focus, determination, and persistence. They use what works, and since phishing works, then by all means, they'll fish. James Traynor is currently Senior Vice President, Cyber Solutions Group at Aon, but recently he was the Assistant Director, Cyber Division of the U.S. FBI. He told the summit that in his experience he'd long seen connections among organized cybercrime and the espionage services of what he called the Big Four threat actors: Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. But there are significant national differences in the way each of the Big Four interacts with crime. For example, Russia tends to make direct use of criminal organizations almost as subcontractors. In the case of China, one tends to see government officers moonlighting as cybercriminals without direct official sanction as a kind of private enterprise. Iran's relationships, Traynor said, were too complex for easy characterization, but North Korea's case is easily understood. The government itself engages in criminal activity for the state's profit. Such observations about international cyber conflict are particularly timely as U.S. congressional inquiry into Russian influence operations continues. We'll continue to follow those hearings with interest. Reports suggest that the European Union will soon mandate backdoors in encrypted communications. The Register says that companies who don't anticipate and voluntarily comply will find a hammer dropped on them sometime in June. This anti-encryption stance, motivated in part by concerns about police ability to monitor and stop incipient terrorist activity, seems to be in tension, to say the least, with the stringent privacy protections the EU also wishes to put in place. Researchers at Palo Alto Networks have found two remote access Trojans, Troikalis and Moonwind, in active use against utilities and other targets in Thailand. Open source developers using GitHub should beware. The Dimny Trojan is there and being used against them. Finally, Gizmodo says it's found FBI Director Comey's Twitter account. It's long been known Director Comey was on Twitter, but exactly what his handle was he coyly kept secret, which would explain the small number of followers he claimed, less than 10. The director's handle turns out to be an homage to theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. You'd think a Chicago man would have chosen Paul Tillich or Paul Ricoeur, but we don't know. Maybe you go to Twitter with the theologians you got.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Jonathan Katz. He's a professor of computer science at the University of Maryland and also director of the Maryland Cybersecurity Center. Jonathan, we saw a story come by about this cryptocurrency called Zcoin. Turns out they have a vulnerability.
Yeah, that's right. They announced a vulnerability a couple weeks ago. And what they had noticed was that a hacker was able essentially to spend about $500,000 worth of their cryptocurrency that they weren't, of course, supposed to spend. And once they noticed that, they started digging into the code and they found actually that their code was indeed vulnerable to an attack, and they went ahead and patched it. And to their credit, they were very public about it. They announced this vulnerability. They announced this mistake on their blog. And then they followed up with a more detailed post afterward explaining what exactly had happened.
According to the story, this was a case of a simple one-digit typo.
It's really unbelievable. It was exactly that. It was a one-character typo in their code. And what this allowed the attacker to do was to essentially respend coins multiple times, which is something you're obviously not supposed to do. And for those of the listeners who know a little bit of programming, it came down to a simple error of using a double equal sign rather than a single equal sign. So the double equal sign is meant to test equality between two values, and the single equal sign is meant to be an assignment of one value to another variable. And just that one error in the code allowed the attacker to go ahead and double spend all these coins.
And this is the kind of error that can make it through, you know, your usual rounds of testing.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's not one of the things that typical static analysis, for example, would find. It's an error kind of in the logical portion of the code, and you'd have to really understand what the code is supposed to be doing in order to find it, which means that these automated analyzers are probably not going to be able to find it, but you need really humans to be involved and to be checking the code and to spot the error. Looking at the code, which is available on their blog, as I mentioned, it is kind of surprising that it wasn't caught earlier, but, you know, it's one of these things where just a mistype and a single character error, like I said, can cause these problems. And I guess if you look at the same code too many times, you don't even notice these kind of things anymore.
Yeah, and in this case, nearly $500,000 worth of problems.
Yeah, that's right. It's really one thing interesting about these cryptocurrencies, of course, is that anytime there's a vulnerability, you can be sure someone's out there looking to make money off of it, because these cryptocurrencies are have value in the real world. And so you can be sure that people are constantly looking to take advantage of them.
Jonathan Katz, thanks for joining us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's VANTA.com/cyber.
My guest today is Bob Ackerman. He's founder and managing director of Allegis Capital, a seed and early stage venture capital firm focused on cybersecurity. He's also a board member at DataTribe, which he describes as a startup co-creation studio that builds disruptive startups in the domains of data, analytics, and cybersecurity. He joined us in our studios in Baltimore.
You know, I think we're kind of at an interesting place in the development cycle of the market. I sort of look at the last few years as large-scale efforts to kind of remediate gaps and holes in cyber defenses. So if you imagine a dike with 1,000 holes in it, a lot of people running around trying to put fingers in those holes. And that's important. You know, it's important because the architecture that we're living with today basically is based on a 50-year legacy. It wasn't designed with the level of data integration, speed or velocity of data movement that we have today. And so inevitably there are gaps that need to be plugged, and that's not going to go away for the foreseeable future. But I think we're on the cusp of sort of what I'll call the second wave of innovation, where people are beginning to think, based on that first wave, about more effective systems. What have we learned in that first wave of innovation? How do we begin to get ahead of some of these threats as opposed to purely responding to them? So think of this as, how do we stop water from getting through the dike? And so I think that's a really interesting area that we're beginning to move into, where we'll see a lot of innovation. And then you look at things like orchestration and automation, where clearly, we're ready for that second wave where we need to fill the skills gap. We need to be able to respond more rapidly to a threat environment, levels of automation to assist threat analysts in responding to those threats. Good example of second wave of innovation. How do you begin to, build the stack so that your people are more effective and your offenses are stronger from the outset?
What about consolidation? Are you seeing a lot of that in our future?
I think consolidation is inevitable in any industry, number one, and cyber is not going to be any different. I think what's different about cyber is innovation will continue apace along with consolidation. So if you think about it, we're kind of rolling up the past areas of innovation. There'll be consolidation there while we push ahead in new areas of innovation. Historically, if you looked at innovation, the initial wave of innovation is driven by what I call hype and hope. The world will never be the same. We've got to grab part of that. The second wave of innovation is sort of rationalization. Okay, what did we learn in the first wave? Now let's be a little more thoughtful, a little more deliberative about what we're innovating around. The third is that consolidation, which historically is more of a maturation of an industry cycle. We're going to see the consolidation in cyber, but it's not about maturation. It's just about building the baseline of functionality so that innovation can focus in the new areas. The nature of cyber, as you well know, is just, bad guys versus good guys. Innovation is a constant. It moves at a very rapid pace. But at some point in time, we kind of have to clean up behind ourselves and integrate this functionality, which is essential, into platforms that are a baseline of functionality and allows us to focus on new areas of innovation like homomorphic encryption or data provenance or orchestration and automation. I mean, if you stop and think about it, security analytics, orchestration and automation, do the two of them come together, consolidate, and is that SIEM 3.0? So you've got this rationalization of the building blocks into larger pieces so that innovation can be focused in the areas which are more differentiated and really represent the cutting edge.
Do you consider cybersecurity to be fundamentally different from other industries?
Yeah, I do. I mean, if you stop and think about cyber, I can't think of another area of technology where innovation is a daily mandate from a technical perspective. I mean, if you think about the sharing economy, the Lyfts and Ubers of the world, the innovation is around a business model. It's important, but there's not that continual drive for technical innovation. Cyber, if you step back and look at cyber, there's a tendency to think about cybersecurity as a vertical niche. I would argue that that is about as wrong as you could possibly be. In fact, cyber is broadly horizontal. You know, the global economy today operates on a digital substrate, you know, and cyber is about that digital substrate. So cybersecurity is as broad as information technology. So, you know, you have information technology evolving all the time. Cyber is evolving with it. You have this legacy architecture that has all sorts of gaps and holes. So in terms of a domain for innovation, it's about as big as you can possibly imagine. And because the bad guys are very adroit at kind of identifying vulnerabilities and exploiting those vulnerabilities, the good guys are running around, you know, equally challenged to either anticipate where those vulnerabilities are or to respond to vulnerabilities that have been identified. So innovation in this space is on a day-to-day basis. It's one of the reasons why it's difficult, quite frankly, for cybersecurity companies when they're public, you know, to continue to innovate as quickly as possible. As you get larger, it's harder to innovate as quickly as you need to be in order to be at the cutting edge in cybersecurity. So it's a market segment, if you will, that is more driven by innovation than anything I can think of, certainly in my career.
That's Bob Ackerman from Allegis Capital and Data Tribe.
And that's the CyberWire. We are proudly produced in Maryland by our talented team of editors and producers. I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.